Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:16 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Summer Time. Today is March 29th, so it is the end of the first quarter. I think it's a good time to start thinking about long-term themes. This being the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Let's kick off with Lyft. It had its IPO in here today, and what I really like to see is the kind of commentary we've seen to say Lyft was up off its opening value, and yet if we look at the intraday chart, it has done nothing but trend down all day. So that is a great example of the headlines belying what we can see in the market. And this is a big question. It's how do you value a company that is never going to make any money? So the only way that Lyft is going to make a profit is if they start charging more without losing market share. But why on earth would we pay more when you can use a taxi to do just about everything that Lyft does? Therefore, there is a very big question there. Then, of course, the real if you can't raise prices without damaging your market share, then you've got to start cutting costs elsewhere. Well, the obvious cost would be workers. Well, workers don't like having their pay cut, and the Uber drivers are going on strike in Los Angeles because they want the same pay deal that drivers in New York are getting. Obviously, in a city that is plagued by traffic, then they want to get paid for sitting around just the same way that taxi drivers do. Of course, that opens up big questions. Well, then we have the fact that there are going to be a lot of these very large privately held, well, perhaps it is a better way to think about it, is highly valued private companies rather than very large, considering that the valuations that have been accrued by these companies has been greatly enhanced by the quantity of money that's been sloshing around. So we are going to get a weighing mechanism as they progressively come towards IPO. What I find particularly interesting is that I created a chart to attempt to try and find a measure for the number of shares outstanding about 6 years ago. And what was particularly interesting is that the size of the float on Wall Street increased between 2012 and 2016. That's despite the fact that we had lots of buybacks. What, of course, we've subsequently learned, and this is research that has become more public over the course of the last few months, is that the quantity of buybacks might have been epic in size, but so has been the issuance of shares to the top executive branches of many corporations, and one has in large part cancelled the other, with the net result that we have had some contraction in the number of shares outstanding, but it is nowhere near where people were really thinking of that restriction of the availability of shares. What it also means is that there is an argument for looking at market cap based charts for the exceptions. Generally speaking, the market cap should increase by and large with the size of the company. If, on the other hand, we're starting to see a significant number of shares, well, then that is, and the price continues to rise, well, that would create an acceleration in the market cap. And that's something that we could potentially start to look at. I think that is, that's. There are times when looking at market caps are going to be rather instructive in terms of the fabric of the stock market, and I think this is a particularly interesting time to start doing that for the simple reason that when we think about any market, well, All markets are dictated by supply and demand. But supply is much more volatile than demand is. Demand tends to trend higher in a reasonably consistent manner. That's particularly the case for commodities because demand is linked to GDP growth. But it's pretty similar in terms of the stock market or the bond markets because of GDP growth and because of people saving for pensions. So there is a steady flow of money into various asset classes, but it is supply that becomes the elastic component in that relationship. And with the number of IPOs that are being lined up, for example, Uber is racing to get an IPO done. Then we're going to have Pinterest. We had Levi Strauss in just the last couple of weeks. I think that's rather interesting considering that they've been private for a rather long time, and so far the price has been steady, but that's against a background where Diesel Jeans, which is more of a, I think, perhaps a niche brand, is on the cusp of bankruptcy. Well, that gives us a very good example of the fact that individual companies need to be weighed on their individual prospects, but the number of IPOs that is planned represents a slug of additional supply at a time when people are starting to worry about the next recession. Now, the yield curve spread, which is the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year, continues to contract, but it has not yet inverted. Where we have seen an inversion is in the front end of the curve and the 10-year. So between the 1 year and the, excuse me, between anything up to 1 year and the 10-year, we have had an inversion. There's also an inversion between the anything up to 1 year and the 2 year, and indeed the 5 year and the 7 year. So that really is more of, I think, an example of a significant belly in the curve. And when we look at that chart, well, what we're presented with is this clear conclusion among investors that there are going to be interest rate cuts within the next 12 months. That's already been priced into the market. That is a clear conclusion then that bond market investors are starting to price in the potential for an economic contraction within the next 12 months. It's usually not until the Federal Reserve starts to lower interest rates in response to sharply slowing growth that the stock market really does react. So, what's particularly interesting right now is the S&P 500 is finishing out the quarter in positive territory, and this has been a really impressive advance. What I've also been thinking about is this contention by Ray Dalio that we're in a period of time that's similar to 1937. In 1937, the market peaked around the March-April period and then collapsed. So I think it is perhaps worth looking at that particular year, because then we're going to get some intelligence as to what exactly he was talking about. And when we think about that particular set of circumstances, well, what we're presented with then is his conclusion that the reason it's similar to the outlook that we have in markets is really more about the fact that when we look at the rise of populism, that we haven't had a rise in populism similar to what has happened recently since the late 1930s. That doesn't necessarily mean that the trajectory of the stock market is going to follow the same outlay, but we do know there's an awful lot of debt out there, and that there is increasing potential for further monetary policy accommodation. Well, when we look at what happened in 1937, the market peaked in March, declined into June, had a subsequent rally, and then collapsed in August. And subsequent to that, we had a very significant period of not much of anything happening in the stock market. So that was, I think, a really quite impressive decline. But then also, we had a very lengthy period where it was really not until the end of the war that things started to really improve in the markets. Well, if we were on the cusp of another world war, we can see, for example, that the market priced it in well ahead of the actual event starting in 1939. So that's also something we've seen, for example, in Israel, that generally when there has been an uptick in really significant hostilities between Israel and its neighbors, the stock market tends to react first. Of course, part of the reason for that is because of insider trading. That's not something anybody really likes talking about, but it is a very real eventuality. Now, when we start to then begin to price in these sorts of changes, what I think is much more instructive is not 1937, it's 2012. And if we look at 2012, then we're presented with something that's rather different. Because what did we have at the beginning of that year? We had really just had the end of one of the bouts of quantitative easing. And people were really worried. So when we look at what happened in terms of the end of 2011, we had had a really significant period of volatility all the way between August and October. Then we had a rally and then a subsequent pullback all the way through until the beginning of where we might anticipate a Santa Claus rally around the Thanksgiving Day holiday. But it was really on the 1st of January that the market just started to rally. And all the way through 2012, all the way through until the end of March, it did really very, very well. It wasn't until the end of the first quarter that we saw the first wobble come through, and then a subsequent decline into the towards the middle of the year. But it finished out the year pretty close to where it had peaked in March. One of the reasons that the market subsequently did so very well was because of QE3. One of the reasons why we had that bout of volatility in 2011 was because of the end of quantitative easing. Well, that's very similar to the kinds of conditions that we've had in here this year. We've had not just the end of quantitative easing, but we've also had the rising of interest rates, the reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and the very large question writ large has been, where is the next round of liquidity provision going to come from in order to provide the stimulus necessary to enhance asset prices? And really, until the beginning of this year, we didn't have a clear answer for that. Well, then you had the Federal Reserve take a major U-turn. So they are now very much thinking about lowering interest rates, stopping reducing the size of their balance sheet. And in fact, just by normal operations, they're going to be increasing the size of the balance sheet before the end of this year. You have Europe, where they've just announced the LTRO program. So they're going to be providing additional liquidity to their banks, at least in part to compensate those banks for negative deposit rates. Then in China, they have been campaigning against the shadow banking sector. And the shadow banks have, well, they scared the Chinese administration back in 2015-16. The size of the shadow banking sector had gone from virtually zero back in 2009 and 10 to not far off 10 trillion renminbi by the time it was forcefully peaked in back in 2016, and now that has gone negative. So if we were looking for one reason why the Chinese market has been underperforming for the last few years, well, that's a pretty good reason. They have been trying to contain speculative interest since the peak in the stock market back in 2015. And that job is now done. So at the end of the Communist Party Congress 2 weeks ago, you had Li Keqiang saying that the banks need to start providing liquidity to the private sector. That followed on from the announcement that they're going to start treating the private sector on an equal footing with the public sector. That's also good news. And then, of course, we have the real potential that there is going to be a favorable outcome to the U.S.-China trade dispute. And the stock market is voting with its feet, and we're back in a demand-dominated environment for the Chinese stocks. Well, when we look at the U.S. and developed markets, one of the adages that David had created was that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. And the tightening of liquidity from particularly from March of last year was a very significant factor in the underperformance of the stock market last year. What we're now starting to see is that this measure of liquidity has been contracting since February of this year, and it is coming back down towards the lows we saw in November. Well, we're going to have to see a turnaround in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a liquidity-rich environment. The kinds of things that would turn this measure around, this is the central bank balance sheets all totted up and then rebased to US dollars. Well, if the Federal Reserve starts to increase the size of its balance sheet, or the ECB, or the Bank of Japan, or the People's Bank of China, that will have a measurable impact on this index. But the other big question is about the strength of the dollar, because the dollar index remains really quite firm, and that's despite the fact that US growth has been slowing. Because despite the fact that US growth has been slowing, it's still faster than just about everywhere else. It's going to take some time for the kind of stimulative measures that are being put in place, particularly in Europe and China, to start to have an effect on the global economy. Whereas the, and that's, I think, still likely to be bullish for the dollar. Then, of course, you have to, I think, pay some consideration to the fact that the dollar index is extremely heavily weighted by the euro, and Europe still has a significant number of challenges lying in front of it. Well, if we look at the Bloomberg Dollar Index, then that takes the weighting of the euro down to about 30%. And but even there's still a succession of high reaction lows for the dollar. That also then is highly supportive of the continued performance of large caps. So we have had a very impressive rally all the way through the first quarter. And now the question is whether it can continue higher in as consistent a manner. The pace of the advance has moderated over the course of the last 2 months, and we are coming back towards this region of the September high around 2900, Well, when we look at this on a weekly basis, I don't think it would require a PhD to consider that there's likely to be at least some pause and consolidation in the region of this 2900 point level. The big arbiter of whether this is just a medium-term range or a developing top formation is going to be the extent to which the market is able to continue to find support in the region of the trend mean. It has over 100 points in which to consolidate, and it would still be a reasonably consistent medium-term advance. Then, when we think about the liquidity environment and marry that up with the fact that we have got this very clear conclusion from bond investors that there is going to be a range of interest rate cuts, 2-year yields have pulled back in a very dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 weeks. They did encounter resistance in here this week. So what that is at least suggesting in the short term is that we are going to get some pause and consolidation. This does not look like anything other than just that, a pause and consolidation within an otherwise really quite bullish environment. When we look at the futures prices, this has been a very clear break of the trend. And that raises rather large questions about the outlook for the bond market, or the bear market hypothesis relating to bonds. There is something that has been at the back of my mind for a long time, and it is that if something is impossible, it can't occur. And it's impossible for the US government to fund itself and then also have a massive increase in interest payments. So therefore, there has to be a solution to that arises that starts to answer the question of what is it that is going to happen in order to avoid that scenario. And potentially, we have an answer to that scenario now because the Federal Reserve is already moving in to provide assistance. And that is at least a partial rescue of the US government. Just by saying that they're willing to moderate the pace of contracting the size of the balance sheet, and then the bond market has done the rest and priced in that we're going to have interest rate cuts, this has been a meaningful improvement in the cost of funding for the US government, and there is a large quantity of bonds that need to be refinanced this year. It is not at all in the interests of either the government or the Federal Reserve to have a significantly higher yield, and that's a very clear failed upside break above 3%. Where we're going to have a clear indication that we are in a bear market for bonds is when people stop buying the dips. We've had a very significant dip in bond prices, and now we're getting a really rather significant rally, although it is now due for some consolidation. But if we do see interest rate cuts, then that is likely to to result in tighter yields. That will also remove some of the tailwind from the US dollar. When we look at what exactly is going on in Europe, well, the Euro Stoxx index has been ranging below the 450 area since the year 2000, and it has had a very choppy advance over the course of the last 4 years, but it has rebounded. And it is in the region of the trend mean, and it is firming from the region of the trend mean in here today. Well, that suggests that Europe does have the potential to recover, at least to push back up towards the upper side of this very lengthy range. It also really suggests that there is no prospect of the ECB raising interest rates, that they're likely to be mired in a quantitative easing type environment for the foreseeable future. And that is as much a factor of demographics as it is for the outlook for their economy. There does seem to be a very clear correlation between the yield on government bonds and the median age of the population. And that does represent a challenge to the bear market hypothesis for bonds. If you have lots and lots of older people without an influx of young people, then consumption does go down. Well, Europe is dealing today with a massive immigration surge. That will reduce the median age over time because immigrants do tend to have more children. But it's going to change the complexion of those economies really quite considerably. It's also worth noting that the USA's median age is considerably younger than that of the majority of European countries, and not least because of the influx of immigrants that are walking over the southern border on a sustained basis. But then on the other end of the curve, you have India with 1.3 billion people and a median age of about 27, and those people are going to be striving towards a better standard of living and higher spending per capita going forward for at least the next 20 years. That represents the clear potential for yields to contract over that time. Well, that is where the value argument comes from when we're thinking about the rise of the global consumer and the demographic dividend that these kinds of high population young countries really gain from in terms of the longer term GDP growth scenario. So I think this is one of the most instructive charts that I've seen in a very long period of time. When we look at the outlook for the Indian market, it's been outperforming in a very clear manner for a sustained period, and that is unlikely to change. This is a secular bull market, and the banking index is at new highs. So that is telling us that not only is it a secular bull market, but that it is being driven by credit growth, and that's obviously very positive for the banking sector. So that's an additional positive in its favor. What India needs more than anything else is a manufacturing sector. And that is the one thing that could help to change the downward trend of the rupee. Here we see a secular advance in terms of the US dollar, but the rupee has been strengthening up, and it is now below its or the dollar is below its trend mean, and this is against a background where the dollar has been among the firmest currencies in the world. Well, the rupee is a little bit overbought in the short term, so there is certainly scope for some consolidation. And we know that there is an election coming up, and that represents a significant source of uncertainty. But there is the clear potential that India is going to be a buy on the dips type market for decades to come. And not least because you have improving standards of governance. That doesn't mean that governance is on the same standard as we have in other countries, but it is, in terms of governance, it's not really about the absolute level, but rather the trend. India has an independent judiciary, it has respect for minority shareholder interests, and it has a free press. So those are really quite attractive characteristics from the perspective of an investor, because it means that once you put your money in, you have a good chance that you might be able to take it back out, that your shares are unlikely to be acquired without your knowledge or say so by either the government or vested interests, and that at least you have recourse to the courts if that were to occur, and you have recourse to the journalists in order to out the worst excesses of government. So those are the important characteristics. One of the reasons why the Chinese market has been so jerky over the very long term is because of the lack of governance. It is prone to bubbles because of the clear reliance of the market on the favor of government. You do not have an independent judiciary, you do not have respect for minority shareholder interests, and you certainly don't have a free press. And rather than the trend being towards achieving those particular attributes that are prized by investors, I think it's arguable that we're going the other way. So what that suggests is that China is a trader's market, whereas India is an investor's market. And bull markets in China are state-sponsored, and there is a new bull market has just started. And that suggests that it is going to be a very interesting place to be over the course of the next perhaps year to 18 months, and then we're probably likely to get another crash. So that's probably what we can expect from the Chinese market, whereas India's market is also liable to have occasional bouts of volatility, but that's unlikely to really question that we're not going to have a succession of higher reaction lows from that market. That's, I think, the one big difference in terms of looking at emerging markets is in terms of their governance. That's one of the reasons why Turkey is so much in the headlines at present. The lira collapsed in August of last year, and now it is right in the region of the trend mean. There are significant measures right now to dampen down the volatility in the currency ahead of the elections at the weekend, but there is very little prospect that the lira is going to strengthen through the 200-day moving average. Much more likely is that we're into another range similar to the ranges we've seen previously, following the other significant devaluations. And when we look at this on a longer-term log scale chart, that puts into perspective the fact that devaluations occur on approximately an 18-month basis, maybe a bit longer than that, in Turkey. That it is extraordinarily unlikely we're going to see the rate strengthen through 5, and much more likely that we're going to see it weaken through 7, if not soon, well then later. And that is as a direct response to the dearth of governance. So we don't necessarily have to conclude that we're going to have improving governance everywhere, but rather that there is a market in governance now, and that is contributing to significant variation in the performance of all markets, not just emerging markets. I think when David coined the phrase governance is everything, he was referring to emerging markets, but later corrected that and just said governance is everything, full stop. That is also a major consideration when we think about what's going on in Europe and in the UK and in the USA. Is governance in fact improving? Or are we getting retrograde steps? And that's, I think, a big question. It's a major question when we start to think about the fact that central banks have been engaged in this extraordinary quantitative easing and monetary, and now with governments in tow, fiscal stimulus. Well, that is obviously debasing currencies. And that creates a bull market environment for gold. Well, gold prices pulled back rather sharply yesterday, and now we have a lower rally high, and it's right in the region of the trend mean. So we need to see gold holding this $1,275 area, and then it needs to push up and out of this short-term range. Palladium prices had been the clear outperformer in the precious metals and pulled back in a very dynamic manner in here over the last 2 days before steadying today. Well, that's a peak of at least medium-term significance, and it suggests that we are now into what could potentially be a lengthy consolidation for the palladium price. Then platinum prices. Oops, I didn't press the right button. Platinum prices have been steadying around the 800 area for much of the last 6 months. So far, it is right in the region of the trend mean, and it has held the sequence of higher reaction lows, but it needs to push above $900 in order to clearly demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, precious metals do well in a negative real interest rate environment. And we get negative real interest rate environments when inflation remains at least steady and central banks are willing to cut interest rates. That is very similar to the kinds of conditions that we have today. There is clear evidence of inflation in the price of goods being bought online. The fact is that Apple is raising prices, Amazon is raising prices, Netflix is raising prices. Where we're not seeing evidence of price rises is in food commodities yet. But we are starting to see that industrial resources are starting to improve. There was a significant move in copper in here today. This continues to look like a first step above the base. So that's, I think, an important factor, that we put in a base at the end of last year, and now it is finding support in the region of the trend mean. So this does look like a recovery scenario. When we look at the LME Metals Index, then it is now also back above the trend mean. So this does look like a recovery scenario. Well, if we're starting to get the outlook for metals improving and consumer goods starting to increase in price, because the postal service has been increasing prices, Amazon has been increasing the costs that it has been imposing on sellers on its network, which has forced them to raise prices. There has been some sticker shock among car buyers, that it now costs in the order of $50,000 to buy a pickup truck, and that is a significant cost inflation for a lot of regular people. Well, these are all factors that are contributing to inflation, and yet the central banks are getting ready to cut interest rates. Well, that is clearly raising the potential for negative real interest rates that are potentially stagflation if growth figures don't keep up. We are definitely seeing the rise of demands for higher wages. That is not just a US phenomenon, it is occurring in a large number of countries, and it's a direct response to the rise of populism, because when we think about the rise of populism, then it is as a direct rebellion against the status quo. It has taken on a number of characteristics, where people have seen that they've lost jobs. Because of globalization, then there has been an uptick in xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment, where it's people that have had lower standards of living because of institutional corruption. Then what we've seen just recently has been the rise of anti-corruption candidates in places like Slovakia and the Ukraine, where people have been disillusioned by the ability of the government to control crime. Then we've had anti-crime prime ministers elected, like in the Philippines, or indeed in Brazil. Well, what this all represents is not simply that we have a lurch to the right, because there has also been a lurch evident to the left. The success of AMLO in Mexico is the evidence that we are getting left-wing populists capable of achieving electoral success. So rather than think about it being as a left-right dichotomy, it is rather a much bigger picture where we're getting a revolt against the status quo because the status quo has singularly failed to improve upon the living standards of millions of people. That is going to require a reset. And the only way we're going to get to a reset is through a further polarization of the potential outcomes. It's in some places going to represent higher taxes. It's going to represent protectionism in others. It's going to represent the potentially, and this is a clear potential, much higher taxes in some places. So far, right-wing populism, and I don't think, and I'm going to stop thinking or speaking about right and left-wing. I think that it makes absolutely no sense to do that, and both are very loaded terms. There is really only one way of thinking about any potential government and set of regulations, and that is in respect for property rights. If a government has respect for property rights, then it's going to be market friendly. If a government does not have respect for property rights, then that is going to be market unfriendly. That's the clear conclusion. That is something that we are definitely being presented with in an increasingly large number of countries. So when we look at what's going on in India, well, there is no doubt that Narendra Modi is a right-wing populist, but it's about he has clear respect for property rights, and that is positive for markets. Well, if Bernie Sanders were to become president of America, then that is going to raise big questions about property rights, and then that would be greeted with a very significant decline in the stock market. Well, the one thing that we know about an inverted yield curve, and with a belly in the curve like we have, there isn't much point in talking about whether it is going to be whether the yield curve spread is an accurate lead indicator for a recession, whether it is right all the time, whether it is even the best one. But what we do know is that it's a lead indicator, not a coincident indicator, that markets have got the potential to rally rather significantly after the yield curve becomes inverted, because you get this argument. You get people really having a big discussion about whether it is enough to derail the growth trajectory that is evident in markets. And that's exactly what we're having right now. We're still in a benign environment instead in terms of the stock market. That will not always be the case. The fact that the banking sector is underperforming is something that is non-trivial, and that represents the tightening of liquidity. So when we look at the global economy, we know that from the total central bank assets that liquidity is tightening. We also know that banks are underperforming, that it's not just US banks, but that it is European banks. So European banks are still below the trend mean, despite the fact that they were somewhat more positive in here this week. When we look at the Japanese banks, then they have so far not been able to rally, and we're in negative territory in here today. The second section index in Japan is a clear lead indicator, and it has so far failed to sustain a move back above the trend mean, which is not a really very positive development, particularly in view of the fact that we have a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend put in December. This is about the most textbook example of a massive reaction against the prevailing trend and type 2 top I've ever seen. So it is going to require some significant bullish action to reverse the downward trajectory here. If banks are underperforming, that means liquidity is constrained. Then, if we look at what would be considered to be cyclical sectors, then the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has so far failed to sustain a move above the 1400 point level. And that was a significant failure at the new all-time high back in the middle of last week. So we are at a point where there is potential for some consolidation in here. Generally speaking, we can anticipate that markets do rally for an additional 6 months after we get an inversion. And that's when things start to roll over. Obviously, when we think about the outlook for this market, there are two, I think, very important arbiters. One is the fact that the dollar is still firm, and then that is representing a tailwind for Wall Street, and Wall Street has been the best performing region over the course of this bull market. The Russell 2000 is interest rate sensitive, and with the outlook for interest rates starting to contract, then we've had some steadying in this index, but it has not yet done enough to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Then, considering the size of the expanded FANG designation, their performance is going to be a significant arbiter of sentiment towards the market, and it is above the trend mean. If, however, it was sustaining a move below 2500, well, then that would be a rather bearish phenomenon. I think the two most important shares in the world at the moment are Google, which has paused around the 1200 area, but it is still well above its trend mean, and Amazon. Amazon is effectively the US consumer, and it has been able to push up and out of that range that persisted between January and February. As long as it's holding that breakout to new recovery highs, following the downtrend from the peak in September, then I think we can be reasonably sanguine about the markets. But if these kinds of shares are starting to lose consistency, then that are not just lose consistency because that's already happened, but if they can't then start to repair it even further, then that is going to be something that we need to worry about. So we are now on recession watch. This is the time when stops need to be imposed. It's the time when we need to be most, I think, interested in what is happening in terms of monetary policy. We are definitely seeing the potential that interest rates are going to drop. Then that is something that, if it happens sooner rather than later, then we could avoid a recession. It's unlikely, though, that we're going to avoid volatility because if interest rates were to fall without an immediate source of data to support that decision, people would likely panic. So it's usually when interest rates fall first that we get increased volatility in markets because that's when people really do start to price in a recession. What this also suggests is that this is the time to pay particular attention to stops because we are late in the cycle. But we're late in the medium-term cycle. We're not late in the long-term cycle. When we look at the Dow Gold Ratio, then we're presented with incredible cyclicality over the course of a very long time frame. And the peak was back in 1999, and we generally get 35 years between the peaks, which suggests that the next major peak in stocks is going to be sometime in the early 2030s. And we're a long way from that. By the same token, if we look at the really long-term scale for oil, then it's when oil prices do particularly well that stock markets go sideways, and vice versa. So when oil prices go sideways, stock markets generally tend to do very well. Well, that gives us a clear indication that energy is a massive arbiter of the ability of the global economy to do well and to foster consumer demand. And I do think that oil prices are going to range more than trend for the foreseeable future, because we have such a massive quantity of supply that becomes economic above $80. So if that's the case, that is a clear tailwind to economic growth. And lower energy prices, in conjunction with the rapid pace of technological innovation, is a really significant tailwind to the global economy. So that is an additional point that is, I think, really quite bullish. Then we have the rise of the global consumer, which is particularly good for companies. So when you start to string these things together, these are themes that are going to persist beyond the, I think, 2-year risk that we're looking at a recession in the USA. Then we're going to get a reassertion of the secular bull market. I think that is the clearest conclusion. What that also suggests is that we're going to get a significant buying opportunity at some point in the next year or two. And then if we think about the US presidential cycle, well, we're due a wobble, that we're at in the first half of the 3rd year of the US presidential cycle. This is exactly the time when you would anticipate that you get a wobble in the stock market, it scares the Federal Reserve, and they start to ease policy. That has been the cycle that we've been seeing for over 100 years, and we're pretty much right on time for when that should start to happen. That means that by the time we get around to the presidential election, that growth could have reaccelerated. And then the big question is who's going to win that election? I really think that that is going to be a very significant question in 2020 that could contribute to a great deal of volatility on stock markets, because I think there is a better than even chance that the progressive wing of the Democrat Party is going to stage a revolution, and they are going to get their candidate on the ticket. And that is going to be a very clear battle between property rights and collectivism, which is obviously going to be a very significant factor for stocks in 2020. Well, I continue to think that there is potential here for some additional upside on stock markets, because that's what we can anticipate immediately after a yield curve inversion. But the underperformance of banks and the fact that central bank balance sheets continue to contract, that does suggest that liquidity is an issue and that it is going to become a more pressing issue, particularly if we get a further deterioration. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.